Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have lots of commentaries, my own and others, the latest on health and healing, including how you could protect yourself against cognitive decline, which is virtually epidemic today in the United States, and how our heartbeats link our mind and our body together. Also, visualized heartbeat can trigger an out-of-body experience. We'll also be having a guest on in the second part of our program, Dmitriev Orlov. We're going to talk about why does the United States want to start another Cold War with Russia and China? Oh, yes, we do. And it's been occurring for the last 4 or 5 years in a more aggressive form. The average American doesn't understand this. So it's time that we took an honest look at what the likely causes are and what will be the outcome. Also, America's Descent into Madness by Professor Henry Giroux, and The Police State Mindset in Our Public Schools by John Whitehead, because it is going on, and I'll give you a lot of examples. And one of the most articulate spokespersons for the independent thinking people who believe in our true democracy is Professor Paul Craig Roberts, and he has written a commentary entitled "Humanity is Drowning in Washington's Criminality." I'll share that with you. And I will get today, because I'm going to make it my first thing after health and nutrition, 10 things everyone should know about the Federal Reserve, because that's a key factor. From our environmental segment today, we're going to examine the free trade jobs lost that's going to come from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This great supposed partnership, and so many things are going to happen to our environment when that occurs. As you can see, we take on the issues that are not covered by the mainstream, or for that matter, in an objective way, the alternative media, because more often than not, what we call the alternative media are corporate-sponsored liberals or Democrats, and you see the topics that they just don't touch, like the politics of AIDS and the corruption within that system, the advocates of vaccines, mandatory testing for children to see if they're mentally ill, because look who gives them their paychecks or who puts the ads on the television stations where they get the big bucks. We don't have that problem, as you will see. Let's go forward now. We have a lot to share. First up, there's some interesting research published in the journal Psychological Science that shows that while we're not necessarily aware of our heartbeat, this inner rhythm actually contributes to how we express the body and what belongs to it. That's according to the latest research. And that's important because it gets the idea that the signals from your heart go to all your internal organs, and then combine with visual information to contribute to self-consciousness. So that's an interesting concept. So it means that your heart isn't just alone and beating to pump blood into the body. In effect, your heart is communicating with every single part of your body. And that's why, for example, when something excites us, the heart beats faster, and if you're at a sporting event, it beats faster, and if you're sharing love, it beats faster. If we're very relaxed, meditative, it beats slower. But that's not just the heart. Every single thing in the body goes in combination with that. So that's very important. So in effect, your heart is the conductor of this wonderful orchestra of all your body processes. And that's getting away from the Descartes notion that everything is separate. It isn't. Everything is integrated. Watermelon juice, according to the newest study published by the American Chemical Society in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry, is great if you're exercising and you're having fatigue in your muscle. And that's because they found that watermelon juice is very high in what is called L-citrulline. And that is a nutrient that helps get the body to get its energy back and relieve soreness in the muscles. Now, when you combine that with a good quality magnesium from citrate, then you shouldn't have any real post-exercise fatigue. Also, University of Michigan did a study. Here's what they found. This is directly from their website. It says, quote, Facebook helps people feel connected, but it doesn't necessarily make them happier. Quote, Facebook use actually predicts declines in a user's well-being, according to this University of Michigan study that is the first known published series examining Facebook's influence on happiness and satisfaction. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal PLOS ONE. Quote, on the surface, Facebook provides an invaluable resource for fulfilling the basic human need for social connection. But rather than enhance well-being, we found that Facebook use predicts the opposite result. It undermines it. This is a result of critical importance because it goes to the very heart of the influence that social networks may have on people's lives. And so think about that for a moment. Think of the people who have to keep looking at their Facebook and Twittering everything and then communicating and sharing everything. The more you need it, the more it creates an unhappiness and anxiety when you're disconnected from it. Recently, we had people attend a two-week retreat as a fundraiser for one of our sister stations, and we told people, don't bring your cell phone, don't bring your computer, because that would be interfering with the flow of energy that you're experiencing when you're close to nature and you're trying to detox and rejuvenate. And people actually went through withdrawal. They became hyper-agitated. It was as if you got them off coffee, and they were going through the caffeine withdrawal and having headaches. Yeah, people can find it difficult to disconnect. So that's one of the reasons I believe that we should only look on our Facebook twice a day, in the morning and in the evening. Anything else that's going to happen will happen no matter what, how much time you spend there. We're spending way too much time as a society on this, and that's creating anxiety, and also, these are not your real friends. We talk about friends and liking something. This is all just, it's all superficial nonsense. And so now they're verifying this. Something has also been verified by a brand new study published in the peer-reviewed journal Diabetes Care, is that the Mediterranean diet counteracts the risk of stroke. And this was a major study done in Spain, and the researchers set out to investigate whether genetics contribute to the cardiovascular benefits seen in the Mediterranean diet. They did a randomized trial of over 7,000 men and women, and they found that the diet itself could make the difference irrespective of what the gene consequence was. And that's important, and that's been shown time and again. So let's just say, how can I put this in lay language? Let's just say you come from a family, and the family has multiple women who've had breast cancer, so you believe it's in the family. And some of the men have had heart attacks, and you say, well, it runs in our family. That's not genetic. That's behavioral. That's conditional. Because what's going to happen is that the people from childhood on mimic others of what they should act like and what positions they should take, what food they should consume, whether to exercise or not. All of those are familial. And so one day you wake up and you find that you have high blood pressure and you think, oh my goodness, you know, it's genetic because I've got seven people in my family that also have it. Well, are these people stressed? Yes. Are they overweight? Yes. Do they eat healthy food? No. Do they supplement? No. Do they express their anxiety in inappropriate ways? Yes. Then it has nothing to do with genes. And that's what this study showed. One more reason why changing over to a healthier diet. I'm not saying that the Mediterranean diet isn't ideal. It isn't. but compared to any other diet that we have, that the average person could adapt to, it's really good. Now, why do I say that? Because I have seen fanaticism in the health movement. In fact, about every 3 to 4 years, someone will come up with something that is radicalized as a promise to improve their health or longevity. They have no really major proof of it, but they'll have a best-selling book, or they'll have a, you know, they'll have a cause, or a multi-level company selling some magic elixir. And then people start using it, looking for some magic panacea, some shortcut. And then sometimes they'll have something so extreme, even if it's good, it would be impossible for the average person to use. Because we have to get out of this supercilious notion that if we know the truth, we'll act on it. If we see a better way, we will engage it. If we know the limitations of our current beliefs, we'll discard them. We don't do that at all. And that's why good people do bad things and smart people do stupid things all the time. So instead, I believe it's much more realistic and much more viable to help people by communicating at a level that they're willing to engage. At what level can a person hear a message and then actualize it? And so, for example, at the health support groups I do, I ask people to make one positive change per week. And that's generally doable for most people. But then I suggest, look, at the end of a year, you've made 52 important positive changes. But if on day one I said, you're going to make all these this week, you're not going to be able to do it. Because you can't decommission and uncondition your behavior. We are too tied in at the epigenetic level to bad habits. Even our insecurities can't just be surrendered by wishful thinking or reading a book. It just doesn't happen. Now, some people try to take shortcuts. They'll go to a spiritual guru and sit at their feet. And suddenly this guru's telling them what to believe in. And even if what the person said was true, and sometimes it could be, it doesn't mean that person's going to go home and actualize it. For example, I know a New York City school teacher that has come to a lot of the events, and I asked one time, you say you go to all these yoga retreats all the time, and you go to these, you know, sleepaway spiritual retreats all the time. Why? All because I get so much, well, hold on a second. How many messages do you have to get from these retreats before you finally get it and actualize it? It would seem that what you're doing, instead of learning something is positive and applying it as you need in your life, you simply look forward to the next retreat and the next retreat and the next yoga session. Well, then how does that really change you? It doesn't. You know, then a yoga retreat can become someone's opiate. So anyhow, just like a 12-step program, I can't tell you how my feelings of how that has missed the mark, and yet they take credit because someone got off alcohol, got off drugs. Did they? Did they change their addictive personality or only change what they were addicted to? There's a difference, big difference. So in our society, we become so used to things that give us pleasure. And many of those things that give us pleasure are not good for us. So then, how do we give them up? Well, maybe 1 or 2%, from my experience, can do it all. They say, that's it, I'm off of it. And they don't go back, and they go forward. Almost always those are dynamic, assertive life energies. Sometimes creative assertives. I haven't seen any other life energies be able to do that. But if you plan it so that they can take incremental steps, and even allowing that they will be challenged by social convention and they'll take a step back, as long as they keep going forward, in time, they will meet a critical point where they will suddenly just no longer want to stay where they were. Suddenly they pick up the pace. Suddenly they're more assertive. Suddenly they're able to see things that were right in front of them before, but now they see them. Now I get it. You'll hear them say that. Now I understand. I didn't know what it was. Right. Now I get it. But you don't know what point that will be, and therefore we have to exercise. We have to exercise exemplary patience and compassion, because we don't know at what moment someone's going to finally turn that corner and stop self-destructive habits. But that's why I believe that the Mediterranean diet is relatively easy for most people, and because they can incorporate more fruits and vegetables, more nuts, and that's not completely alien, and fish, and some dairy. So I would rather see a person go to some dairy than a lot of dairy, to some fish than all meat, and then from there evolve it to where there's less dairy than no dairy, than less fish than no fish, because you have to ask, where are you trying to get to? Are you trying to get to a person in a place where they're going to really be healthy? Then it's got to be incremental. So the Mediterranean diet can get you there. Now, one thing that's going to get you sick and dead in time is sugar. Sugar's really bad for you. And when you consider a study that I found in the literature when I was in England, and I went back to their wonderful library they have, one of the oldest libraries in Europe, and looked at the studies. There was a study in 1906 by a well-respected physician and scientist at the time who was talking about the epidemic of diseases coming from the consumption of sugar, and the average amount of sugar at the time was 3 pounds per year. Already they were defining illnesses from sugar at 3 pounds per year. Now the average amount that a person consumes, the average person, it's over 170 pounds. This is just the latest, and still as a society we refuse to acknowledge its danger because so many people enjoy it. University of Utah biology professor, Professor Wayne Potts, and a PhD student, James Ruff, they did an experiment and to see if sugar was toxic in safe doses. And what they found was that when they fed the mice in this study supposed safe amounts, the, quote, "Our results provide evidence that added sugar consumed at concentrations currently considered safe exerts dramatic adverse impacts on mammalian health," end quote. And they published in the peer-reviewed Nature Communications. Quote, "This demonstrates the adverse effects of added sugars at human relevant levels." So, who told us that this was safe to begin with? Well, the people who manufactured, who hired the scientists, who then convinced the people in the federal government to allow them to be an expert, and then they said, it's safe. No, it's not. It never has been either. If you eat raw garlic twice a week, you can reduce your cancer risk by 44%. In fact, what they found in garlic which is a member of the onion family, and it's been used throughout history for medicinal purposes, is because of its sulfur. It's 1% sulfur by dry weight, which is a lot. And they found that 40% of all cancer patients die within 5 years, and more than 80% die within 12 years, either the cancer or the treatment that was administered for the cancer. But eating garlic twice a week reduces the cancer risk without any side effects. And the reason so many people die with conventional cancer treatment is that while damaging healthy cells, chemotherapy also triggers them to secrete a protein that sustains tumor growth and resistance to future treatment. And only through the forces that have carefully conspired to thwart meaningful advances in cancer research and treatment over the past century has chemotherapy succeeded. And what reality we do live in is the cut, poison, and burn are the only acceptable treatments. But garlic would certainly make a difference. In the preclinical models, they found that garlic can reduce the incidence of breast cancer, colon cancer, skin cancer, uterine cancer, and esophagus cancer, and lung cancers. All good. 44%, and that's the latest on that. And finally, five facts about sweating you probably didn't know. I'll share this from Elizabeth Rettner, and this is the five. These are the five. Because most people know that when you're exercising, you're sweating, fine, but they don't like to sweat otherwise because it's uncomfortable and for a lot of people has a bad odor. Not all sweat stinks. There's actually more than one type of sweat. Smelly sweat is the kind produced by glands called apocrine glands, located in areas where there is more hair, like under your armpits or groin. This is the sweat produced when you are under stress, not the kind associated with a good workout. The smell associated with body odor, and sometimes sweat is actually the result of bacteria breaking it down once it's released from the apocrine glands onto your skin. Women have more sweat glands than men. Women typically have more sweat glands, but men sweat more. In general, we are all around 2 to 4 million sweat glands, with some individuals actually being naturally sweatier than others. And eating can make you sweaty. When you eat, your metabolism naturally increases, and this boosts your body temperature and causes you to sweat in order to cool down. Interestingly, foods like hot peppers, which contain capsaicin, are known to both boost metabolism and make you hot. Sweat glands are most concentrated on the bottoms of your feet. The lowest concentration of sweat glands are on your back, and the most sweat glands are on the feet. Vegetarians sweat smells better. Now, this isn't a ploy to get you to go vegetarian. An actual study looked at how women perceive body odor, comparing the odors of vegetarians to those of meat eaters. Overall, the women found vegetarians to have significantly, quote, more attractive, more pleasant, and less intense odors. How about that? I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Singer. This fella used to come by every day, get a juice. And so actually named a juice after him and put it there in the store. It was a very popular juice. You know who that was? I'm sure I'm not alone in believing that America is on a downward spiral. We are entering a phase of our society's life on all levels that we are about to tip. I believe this tipping will occur in the next 5 years, at the most, possibly sooner. America is descending, according to Professor Henry Giroux, into madness. Yes. The stories it now tells are filled with cruelty and deceit and lies and legitimate all manner of corruption. The mainstream media spins stories that are largely racist. I hope that you had a chance to listen to my counter push to Bill O'Reilly on what I considered his extremely disjointed and racist points of view. The mainstream media promotes violence, and I feel is completely irresponsible, because they share stories that celebrate power, but at the same time they demonize victims, all the while camouflaging the influence under the cheap veneer of entertainment. Unethical grammars of violence now offer the only currency with any enduring value for mediating relationships and addressing problems and offering instant pleasure. A predatory culture celebrates a narcissistic hyper-individualism that radiates a near sociopathic lack of interest in or compassion and responsibility for others. Let me give you an example. At the height of the foreclosures, when over 44 million Americans were losing their homes, entire segments of communities, more than half the people on a single block, there was not a protest to be found where unions of teachers or municipal workers or any of the other neighbors came together and said, what can we do to stop this? Well, you could have withdrawn your money from those banks. You could have protested in unison with the federal government, with your legislators, with the President of the United States. You could have boycotted the association that you had with these. We did not. So we stood back as the vans pulled up and the marshals made sure that the people left. House after house. Well, where is our compassion? Where is our social cohesiveness? Where is our commitment to our neighbor? Anti-public intellectuals dominate the screen and the oral cultures, urging us to shop more, indulge more, make a virtue out of the pursuit of personal gain, all the while promoting a depolitical culture of consumerism, undermining life-affirming social solidarities and any viable notion of the public good. Corporate left and right-wing politicians trade in forms of idiocy and superstition that mesmerize the illiterate and render the thoughtful cynical and disengaged. Military forces armed with the latest weapons from Afghanistan play out their hyper-militarized fantasies on the front by forming robo-SWAT teams who willfully beat youthful protesters and raid neighborhood poker games. Congressional lobbyists for the big corporations and defense contractors create conditions in which war zones abroad can be recreated at home in order to provide endless consumer products, such as high-tech weapons and surveillance tools for gated communities and for the prison alike. The issue of who gets to define the future, own a nation's wealth, shape the reach of state resources, control the global flows of goods and humans, and invest in institutions that educate our engaged and socially responsible citizens has become largely invisible. And yet these are precisely the issues that offer up new categories for defining how matters of representation and education and economic justice and politics are to be defined and fought over. The stories told by corporate liars, are there any other? And crooks, well, they're handmaidens, do serious harm to the body politic, and the damage they cause together with the idiocy they reinforce are becoming more apparent as America descends into authoritarianism, accompanied by the pervasive fear and paranoia that sustains it, the police state. The American public needs more than a show of outrage or endless demonstrations. It needs to develop a formative culture for producing a language of critique and possibility and broad-based political change, such as a project is indispensable for developing an organized politic that speaks to a future that can provide sustainable jobs and decent health care, quality education, and communities of solidarity and support for young people. At stake here is a politics and vision that informs ongoing educational and political struggles to awaken the inhabitants of neoliberal societies to their current reality and what it means to be educated not only to think outside of a savage, market-driven common sense, but also to struggle for those values and hopes and modes of solidarity and power relations and institutions that infuse democracy with a spirit of egalitarianism and economic and social justice. For this reason, any collective struggle that matters has to embrace education at the center of politics and the source of an embryonic vision of a good life outside of the imperatives of predatory capitalism. It is not an impossible task, but it is a difficult one. We are seeing in cities that stretch from Chicago to Athens and other dead zones of capitalism through the world the beginning of a long struggle for the institutions and values and infrastructures that make critical education and community the core of a robust radical democracy. This is a challenge, especially for young people and all those invested in the promise of a democracy that extends not only the meaning of politics, but also a commitment to economic justice and democratic social change. You've heard me mention many times on the show that we are more than the stories we tell, and more often than not, we become pathologically aligned with our stories, even when the stories are not true. And we have a hard time disengaging our insecurity from the certainty that others have believed us in our stories. The stories we tell about ourselves as Americans no longer speak to the ideals of justice and equality and liberty and democracy. There are no towering figures such as Martin Luther King Jr., whose stories interweave moral outrage with courage and vision and inspired us to imagine a society that was never just enough. Stories that once inflamed our imagination now degrade it, overwhelming a populace with nonstop advertisement that reduce our sense of agency to the imperatives of shopping. But there are not the only narratives that diminish our capacity to imagine a better world. We are also inundated with stories of cruelty and fear that undermine communal bonds and tarnish any viable visions of the future. Different stories, one that provided a sense of history, social responsibility, and respect for the public good, were once circulated by our parents and churches and synagogues and schools and community leaders. Today, the stories that define who we are as individuals and as a nation are told by right-wing and liberal media that broadcast the conquests of celebrities, billionaires, and ethically frozen politicians, or talking head pundits, always the same, who say the same, and never change. They preach the mutually related virtues of the free market and a permanent war economy. These neoliberal stories are all the more powerful because they seem to undermine the public's desire for rigorous accountability and critical interrogation and openness as they generate employment and revenue for the right and left-wing think tanks and the policymakers who rush to fill the content needs of corporate media and educational institutions, concealing the conditions of their own making. These stories enshrine both greed and indifference, encouraging massive disparities in wealth and income. In addition, they also sanctify the workings of the market, forging a new political theology that inscribes a sense of our collective destiny to be governed ultimately and exclusively by market forces. Such ideas surely signal a tribute to Ayn Rand's dystopian society, if not also a rebirth of Margaret Thatcher's nonfiction version that preached the neoliberal gospel of wealth. There's nothing beyond the individual gain and the values of the corporate order. So says Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck, Bill O'Reilly, Laura Ingraham. The stories that dominate the American landscape embody what stands for common sense among market and religious fundamentalists in both mainstream political parties. Shock and awe austerity measures, tax cuts that serve the rich and powerful and destroy government programs to help the poor and elderly and the sick. Attempts to suppress the voter ID laws and rig election at the electoral college votes. Full-fledged assaults on the environment, the militarization of everyday life, the destruction of public education, if not critical thought altogether, an ongoing attack on unions, on social provisions, on the expansion of Medicaid and meaningful health care reform. These stories are endless and repeated by the neoliberal and conservative walking dead who roam the planet, sucking the blood and life out of everyone they touch, from the millions killed in foreign wars to the millions incarcerated in our nation's prisons. All of these stories embody what Ernst Bloch has called the swindle of fulfillment. but is instead of fostering a democratic, rooted, public interest society, they encourage a political and economic system controlled by the rich, but carefully packaged in consumerist and militaristic fantasy. Instead of promoting a society that embraces a robust and inclusive social contract, they legitimate a social order that shreds social protections, privileges the wealthy and powerful, and inflicts a maddening and devastating set of injuries upon workers, women, poor minorities, immigrants, and low and middle class young people. Instead of striving for economic and political stability, they inflict on Americans marginalized by class and race uncertainty and proclivity, a world turned upside down in which ignorance becomes a virtue and power and wealth are utilized for ruthlessness and privilege rather than a resource for the public good. In conclusion, every once in a while we catch a brutal glimpse of what America has become in the narrative spun by politicians whose arrogance in quest for authority exceeds their interest to conceal the narrow-mindedness, power-hungry blunders, cruelty, and hardships embedded in the policies they and their sociopathic subordinates advocate. The echoes of a culture of cruelty can be heard in politicians such as Senator Tom Coburn, a Republican from Oklahoma, who believes that even assistance to those unemployed, homeless, and working poor suffering the most in his home state should be cut in the name of austerity measures. We heard in the words of Mike Reynolds, another politician in Oklahoma, who insists that government has no responsibility to provide students with access to a college education through a state program, quote, that provides post-secondary education scholarship to qualified low-income students. We find evidence of a cruelty of culture and numerous policies that make clear that those who occupy the bottom rungs of American society, whether low-income families, poor minorities of color and class, or young, unemployed, and failed consumers, are considered disposable, utterly excluded in terms of ethical considerations and the grammar of human suffering. In the name of austerity, budget cuts are enacted that fall primarily on those individuals and groups who are already disenfranchised, and will thus seriously worsen the lives of those now suffering the most. The general response from the corporate Democrat and liberal community does not take seriously the ways in which the extreme right wing articulates its increasingly pervasive and destructive view of American society, because they have co-joined them or empowered them. And that is essential. Otherwise, how can you accept that the National Defense Authorization Act, or the redoubling down on the Patriot Act, or the universal spying and infringement upon our constitutional rights, or the evisceration of the Fourth, Third, First, and Fifth Amendments were done by Democrats and Republicans alike? And yes, all of the environmental degradation, the special licenses to explore and cause disaster into our Arctic wildlife sanctuaries and the oceans, all done with the full support of both Democrats and Republicans alike. So we, the public, have to become aware. When we gave an opportunity to make a change in all this to Jill Stein, to Rocky Anderson, to Gary Johnson, we said no. When the Nation magazine voted for Barack Obama or supported him, they said no to independent, progressive, and critical thinkers who could actually implement change. And that is where we are today. So I ask you not to think any longer that by staying connected at any level with your bank account or your food shopping or buying a house or in any way using their credit cards or looking at what they are saying, you can no longer be free and be connected to them. Get off their grid, get out of their reality, and become an American citizen again. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Yeah.
My guest will be on in just 5 minutes. He asked us to call in Dmitry Orlov in about 5 minutes. He's on a boat in the water, so we'll get him to talk about why are we looking to start a Cold War with Russia and China. From John Whitehead, the police state mindset in our public schools. Once upon a time in America, parents breathed a sigh of relief when their kids went back to school after a summer's hiatus, content in the knowledge that for a good portion of the day, their kids would be gainfully occupied, out of harm's way and out of trouble. Those were the good old days, before school shootings became a part of our national lexicon and schools, aiming for greater security, transformed themselves into quasi-prisons, complete with surveillance cameras, metal detectors, police patrols, zero-tolerance policies, lockdowns, drug-sniffing dogs, and strip searches. Unfortunately, somewhere along the way, instead of making the school safer, we simply managed to make it more authoritarian. It used to be that if you talked about anything where a student was mean-spirited, or vulgar, or rude to a teacher, or played a prank, or a classmate, or did something foolish, they were just given extra detention, or they had to do a writing assignment after school. Nowadays, students are not only punished for transgressions more minor than those, such as playing cops and robbers on the playground, bringing a Lego to school, or having a food fight, but they are punished with suspension, expulsion, even arrest. As a result, America is now on a fast track to raising up an Orwellian generation, one populated by compliant citizens accustomed to living in a police state and who march in lockstep to the dictates of the government. Indeed, as I pointed out in my book, A Government of Wolves, the emerging American police state, with every school police raid and overzealous punishment that is carried out in the name of school safety, the lessons being imparted is that Americans, especially young people, have no rights at all against the state or the police. In fact, the majority of schools today have adopted an all-or-nothing lockdown mindset that leaves little room for freedom, individuality, or due process. For example, when high schooler Ashley Smithwick grabbed the wrong lunch sack, her father's, on the way to school, the star soccer player had no idea that her mistake would land her in serious legal troubles. Unbeknownst to her, the lunchbox contained her father's little paring knife, just a little 2-inch blade he used to cut his apples during lunch. It was only when a school official searching through the student's belongings found the diminutive knife, the administrators considered that then a weapon, and she was arrested. And the police in turn charged her with possessing, quote, a sharp-pointed or edged instrument on educational property. Or how about Tiska Avery, a diabetic teenager living in Birmingham, Alabama? She was slammed into a filing cabinet and arrested after falling asleep during an in-school suspension. The young lady, who suffered some sleep apnea and asthma, had fallen asleep while reading Huckleberry Finn in detention. After a school official threw a book at her, literally, she went in the hallway to collect herself, and while speaking on the phone with her mother, she was approached from behind by a police officer who slammed her into a filing cabinet and arrested her. Or how about this year when 7 students at Enloe High School, North Carolina, were arrested for throwing water balloons? One parent who witnessed the police slamming their children onto the ground was also arrested and slammed on the ground for calmly expressing his discontent with the way the students were being arrested. Unfortunately, while these may appear to be isolated incidents, they are indicative of a nationwide phenomenon in which children are treated like criminals, especially within public schools. Their ramifications are far-reaching. As Emily Blumenthal, writing for the New York University Review of Law and Social Change, explained, quote, studies have found that youth who have been suspended are at an increased risk of being required to repeat a grade, and suspensions are a strong predictor of later school dropout. Researchers have concluded that suspension often becomes a push-out tool to encourage low-achieving students and those viewed as troublemakers to leave school before graduation. Moreover, as suspensions and arrests for minor failings and childish behavior become increasingly common, so does the spread of mass surveillance in our nation's school. In fact, our schools have become a microcosm of the total surveillance state, which currently dominates America. adopting a host of surveillance technologies, including video cameras, finger and palm scanners, iris scanners, as well as RFID and GPS tracking devices to keep constant watch over the student bodies. And so it is. And yet we never discuss this. My guest is on hold. Let's go over now and say hello to Dmitry Orlov. Nice to have you with us today, Dmitry.
Great to be on your show.
One important question and take it from there. All right, my question is simple. When I look at Russia today, I see an economy based upon $100 a barrel oil that is booming and is one of the wealthiest countries in the world and has the largest production, has the largest resource of oil, and it's growing, and it will get even wealthier. China is doing the same. And yet we are trying to posture ourselves politically that these are both our enemies, not only individually, but collectively. And therefore we should create a new Cold War. We should fear them. We should demonize them. And therefore we should prepare militarily for the inevitability of another conflict. I consider this to be irresponsible. I'd like your points of view and your perspective, because you are far more intimate on this, since you have been as a Russian-American engineer, an author, investigator. You have been there. You were there as an eyewitness during the collapse of the old Soviet Union, and you've researched it extensively. Take us on this dynamic that we're now seeing.
Well, I think that Russia is, or is becoming, a superpower just based on its gigantic resource base, and now its quite powerful economy, which is still growing, unlike the United States. Now, this idea that Russia is somehow the enemy of the United States is basically based on the fact that Russia is now powerful enough to ignore the United States, and is doing that to a great extent. It's not that Russia wants to be America's enemy. It just doesn't want to pay much attention to America. There's a difference there. It treats the United States as largely irrelevant, as a fading has-been of a country. Now, the thing is that, you know, this military posturing is absolutely ridiculous, because everybody knows that the U.S. military cannot prevail in any country, not in Iraq, not in Afghanistan, not even in Somalia. The U.S. military is basically just a gigantic waste of money, and there's this idea that the United States is surrounding Russia and China by putting these military bases in various places around the world. That also doesn't really make a lot of sense. The Russians and the Chinese look at that and see the United States bankrupting itself through this military spending. So that plays into their hand. They don't really, you know, as Sun Tzu said, never interfere when your enemy is busy destroying himself. So they're fine with that as well. So I see this as basically Cold War nostalgia on the part of the United States. They desperately need some kind of an image of an enemy in order to have any sort of justification for having this gigantic but completely incompetent military incapable of victory anywhere in the world that is sucking resources out of the country at an ever-increasing rate.
I appreciate those overviews. When you look at China today, they hold 16 of the 20 largest cities in the world. They have some of the most advanced technology. They've had massive environmental degradation because of their exclusive need for economic growth. Now they're trying to rebalance that. And yet when you would think, well, China has an armed forces and Russia has an armed forces, more than capable together, since they're working together today as on collaboratives, to simply turn around and decide they no longer want to use the dollar as a reserve currency, and without ever firing a missile, without ever spending a dollar more on defense, that could have a devastating effect on the United States if China refused to give any more money to America. Also, they're both part of the BRICS nations, so if all the BRICS nations and additional nations decided, we're going to use our own currencies, the yuan and some others, for our currency exchange, and we're not going to use the dollar would collapse overnight. It would throw us into a crisis we have not seen, surpass even that of the Great Depression. And I believe that they're capable of doing that. Whether they would or not is a matter of conjecture, but they had that possibility. Have we even thought about that, that they could defeat us without having to militarily even engage on that level?
Well, it's already done as far as the BRIC countries. Their internal settlements are all in their reciprocal currencies. They've squeezed out the dollar already. Russia and China no longer use the U.S. dollar in bilateral trade. Same thing with China and Brazil, with Russia and Brazil. These are large economies. And so it's actually spreading now to developing countries, which are also entering into various currency swap type relationships with their trading partners in order to avoid having to pay seigniorage to the U.S. Treasury. So this is very well on the way. Now, how quickly it happens, you know, it could be a slow slide, but then eventually it'll be a rout. The U.S. dollar has lost something like 98% of its value since the U.S. went off the gold standard. So it's not really a currency that you want to hold over the long run, over the long term. And everybody knows that. But how you get out from under it is a good question for a lot of people, because there's still quite a bit of world trade that's denominated in the U.S. dollar, oil especially. And so it is a trend. It is ongoing. It will run its course. As a result of this, the U.S. dollar will be devastated in terms of its value and its standing in the world, and the United States cannot do a thing about it.
How long would you project this might take to unfold, and would it not also create a terrible situation for the average American, because it would cause hyperinflation? The value of the dollar would go down, so that means whatever you were going to buy with the dollar, you'd have to pay more, and the value of what you're getting would be for less.
Well, yes, it will cause inflation, first of all, because it will cause imports to become more expensive. But the other effect that this might have is that a lot of imports in a lot of places will become inaccessible to the average population. So, yes, there will be quite a few disruptions that will happen as a result of this. Now, the nations that export products to the United States don't really want to lose the U.S. as a market abruptly. As long as there's some semblance of a way that the United States can pay for these imports. But increasingly, the United States insists on paying for them with basically printed money or treasury paper that is basically an amount to a bubble of unrepayable debt. And countries around the world, central banks around the world, are basically stocking up on gold and getting rid of U.S. treasuries. And that has been the trend for quite a while now. So when the tipping point arrives, that everybody just basically starts dismissing the dollar very aggressively, I don't know. I don't really want to make predictions as to timing, because there's nothing for me to base them on, because these are just basically panics that happen. And, you know, financial panics are very unpredictable. But one thing that's clear is that the trend is unsustainable.
Final quick thought. Why do you think that we have to go out of our way to try to constantly demonize some country in the world as our ultimate eternal enemy?
Well, because otherwise the United States would be compelled to look inward and realize that it is its own worst enemy. What we do when we create the image of an enemy is we basically take somebody of whom we're completely ignorant, and we project onto that blank slate everything that we hate about ourselves. And that way we can avoid the mental discomfort of actually looking at who we are. And Freud detailed that in quite a few places, and it stands in, as far as who we think our personal enemies are, and it stands for who we think our national enemies are as well. But as far as Russia, there's almost a cottage industry in the United States of vilifying Russia. You know, there's every month there's some article in some newspaper somewhere about how the Russians eat their own young or some preposterous thing like that. And so you just endlessly see the slanted coverage of Russia. with the goal of basically demonizing it and making it look bad. And the thing is that a lot of the time I tell Americans true facts about Russia, what life in Russia is like, and it absolutely amazes them and they think that I'm making it up.
I would like to invite you back for an extended conversation on what life is like in Russia in its entirety.
I would be very happy to do that.
Just a whole show on, if you were to take us to Russia today, in every aspect, in every group, what would we be experiencing? That would take us an hour. So I'm going to invite you back for a conversation with a Remarkable Mind, full hour on our Monday evening Progressive Commentary Hour. All right?
Sounds wonderful.
All the best. Dmitry Orlov, and by the way, he is not just a Russian-American engineer, and also he talks on the environment and political decline. He is the author of several books, including The Five Stages of Collapse, A Survival's Toolkit, and he publishes weekly on a popular blog, Club Orlov, ORLOV.com, for the Energy Bulletin. And he and his family are currently living on a sailboat with solar panels, and they travel for months without hitting land. We'll have him back for a full hour. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on the next program. Have a nice day. Now let's go over and real quick, we'll say hello to Luann Panessi, who I was just told standing by. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I just wanted to make a quick announcement that anyone who's interested in coming to the retreat coming up in October, September 29th through October 6th, or to extend it to the second week, people can come for 1 week or 2 weeks. And we're also having a whole one-month program for people that have chronic illnesses that want to get rid of addictions. We're melding the 2 weeks over the month. But I just wanted to clear that up with people. It's going to be a full month for some people. It's going to be 1 week or 2 weeks. There's a lot of options for people. So if you're interested in and you want to hear more about it, give me a call. My home office is 631-504-6198. Again, it's 631-504-6198. Give me a call. I'll be happy to tell you all about it.
Good. And you can also, we'll go into greater depth about the holistic physician and his team and the hyperbaric and all the other therapies that will be used on the people coming for the month, the ones who have the Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, diabetes, and all the other serious conditions. Okay, good. Let's go over and say hello now to where she's standing by, Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Hello, Luann, if you're still there. But today we were returning to our discussion from yesterday on the Brawley case, and I believe that we may have some very interesting news to announce today.
Good. Okay. Well, we're looking forward to that. In a moment, Utrice Lead.